You're listening to the Fresh Hell Podcast. Fresh Hell contains stories of a disturbing and often graphic nature and is intended for a mature audience. Please don't let your kids listen to this, or they might turn out like us.
Hi, I'm Annie from the U.S.
And I'm Johanna from Austria, and you're listening to your favorite international podcast. Sorry, guys, for not being here 2 weeks ago, but Annie did an absolutely amazing job with that episode all by herself. And also sorry for not being able to upload an episode last week. We know you've all been waiting for the third and final part of this update on the Lady of the Dunes case, but this was honestly so much work for Annie to do all the research for this case, and she really worked too hard to rush it in the end. And then last week, everything was almost ready to record, and then Annie had a horrible migraine attack, and
it was the worst.
You know, it didn't work out.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's like this, but we're back. We're both here.
That's right.
And I think we have a lot to talk about and a lot to cover today. So I'd say, without further ado, here is the third and final part of Annie's absolutely amazing update on the Lady of the Dunes.
Well, now I'm afraid you've built it up a little too much. Okay. So today is the third and final episode covering everything that I have been able to find out since we learned on Halloween 2022 that the unidentified woman murdered in the dunes of Provincetown in 1974 is Ruth Marie Terry. She was from Tennessee and she married Guy Rockwell in Reno, Nevada, only 5 months before she was murdered. We discussed Ruth's murder at length in episode 20 on The Lady of the Dunes, so please do go back and listen to that early episode if you want all of the details, as well as the first two parts leading up to today, because I'll be touching on points that we made and questions that we may have asked during those episodes, and I do not have the time to recap everything. So we left you with the fact that on December 1st, 1960, Guy Rockwell is found with a brand new nose, hair that's been dyed red, and a shaved-off mustache in a shitty little apartment in New York City. Detective Herb Swindler was able to question him for several hours, and I think it's good if we just jump in with an article that will also... I found this article which had one or two facts I wanted to grab from it, but then I was like, this actually is a great... recap. So this is from the News Tribune, Tacoma, Washington, 2nd December 1960, which was a Friday, page 1. And the name of the article is Plans to Try Guy Rockwell Being Pushed. Quote, plans were pushed by King County Prosecutor Charles Carroll Friday to try Guy Rockwell Moldovan, long sought for questioning in the disappearance of his wife and her daughter, on fraud charges. Carroll said not enough evidence had been found to charge anyone with homicide in connection with the discovery of human tissue in a septic tank here last August 30th. A formal request for Moldovan's extraction was flown to New York State Thursday night. Seattle Police Sergeant Herb Swindler left earlier to question Moldovan about the disappearance here last April of his second wife, Mrs. Manzanita Rockwell, and her daughter, Dolores Mearns, 18, a University of Washington co-ed. Moldovan, 37, known in this area as Raoul Guy Rockwell, was nabbed by the FBI early Thursday in an art-cluttered apartment in New York's Greenwich Village. He lived under the name of M. Strong and had shaved off his mustache and dyed his brown hair red. Carroll said he was prepared to try Moldovan on a charge of swindling $10,000 from Mrs. Clifford Winkler. She is the stepmother of Evelyn Emerson, whom Rockwell married July 29, 8 days after divorcing the second Mrs. Rockwell. At Carroll's request, Justice of the Peace William Hoare raised the bail on the bunco charge, technically grand larceny, from $5,000 to $25,000 on Thursday. In New York, Commissioner Bishop scheduled a removal hearing December 8. He ordered Moldovan held in $50,000 bond on an unlawful flight charge. The 200-pound six-footer said he would agree to come back to Washington State.
The nationwide search for him started August 30th after discovery of bits of human body, which officials said were of a young woman, in a freshly cemented septic tank under the building Moldovan used for his antique shop and home here. Earlier, two severed human legs washed up on a bank of the Columbia River in central Washington. They were those of a woman whose physical measurements were about those of 39-year-old Manzanita Rockwell, investigators said. End quote. So that kind of takes us to where we are now. In Ann Rule's book that she wrote, Smoke, Mirrors, and Murder, in her chapter on Guy, called The Antique Dealer's Wife, she talks about how Detective Herb Swindler was a friend and a colleague and how much this case meant to him, which is really saying something because he would later work on the Bundy case. Herb is on the first flight out to the East Coast to have a sit-down with Guy, and he told Ann Rule how he just came so close, he felt, to getting a confession. So he gets there, and it sounds like Law and Order 101, right? It's like, bum, bum, here are a bunch of glossy, horrific photographs. He tried to take advantage of Guy's ego with a sort of like, you're the only one who can make sense of what we're looking at kind of approach, you know? And Guy said to him that he was, quote, morally responsible for the death of Manzanita and Dolores. So in the book by Ann Rule, which is the closest I've found to direct quotes anywhere, it says, quote, I'm morally guilty of Manzanita's and Dolores' deaths, he said slowly. I was the only person living with them and the only person who might have had an opportunity to commit these crimes, end quote.
What?
Yeah. So he never directly comes out and confesses, but he says that he knows that Manzi and Dolores are dead. And he also says that the detective needs to understand that he will never allow himself to be in, quote, a position to hang.
If I say I'm morally guilty of someone's death, then that's like...
And dismemberment. And dismemberment.
That means I didn't personally do it, but maybe I could have prevented it, for example, right? But he's like, I'm morally guilty and I'm pretty much the only person who had the opportunity to do it. So, like, do you understand what morally guilty even implies? Because I don't think you do. Not you, he, you know.
Well, he doesn't have a conscience, so he's trying. He's trying to pretend that he has feelings, you know. Like, he understands what morals are. It's so bizarre to me.
Does he?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure.
I think he knows. He doesn't think they apply to him.
Oh, yeah.
But he understands what he's supposed to do, right? He just doesn't feel guilt. It must be amazing in a way, right? To just... I'd be so much more productive. All right. Anyway. So, yeah. So then he says, one day he'll explain what happened in great detail, but not in his lifetime. Instead, he tells Swindler that he's going to write it all down in his will, word for word, and that's when Swindler will be able to learn everything that's happened. And when Swindler tries to press the issue, I guess he gets interrupted by the police in New York who also want to talk to him. So he claims that was the big, oh no, the police interrupted me and lost my moment and that kind of a thing. But at the end of the day, Guy didn't give anything else up. All he said was that he wanted to speak to a Jesuit priest back in Seattle. Then he starts a hunger strike. So the Bellingham Herald says on Sunday, December 4th, 1960, page 2, the headline reads, Rockwell starts hunger strike. And in this article, it's like a proper article about it, it goes on to explain that he is willing himself to die and hoping to make it happen with a hunger strike. Okay. So he starts his hunger strike on Sunday. And then on Monday, the newspapers report that the hunger pangs were too much and he had called off his hunger strike. So I've had to go without eating for longer than that for a medical test. Like, he's such a fucking wimp.
Well, hold on. He was on a hunger strike for a day. A day.
A day.
Are you serious?
Yeah. I'm serious.
I can't.
I bet the papers were like, oh, we should have waited before we pulled the trigger on that headline. But he was big news, you know, and he knew it. He knew it. And my willpower is, I'm not judging. Like, it's fine, but it's also not. So Guy flies back to Seattle with Detective Swindler, and he meets with a priest on December 7th and again on the 9th. And of course, we have no idea what they discussed because of confidentiality laws. And then, surprise, surprise, Guy goes back on his word to Swindler and doesn't confess anything to him. All he said, according to the Anne Rule book, was, quote, "They are dead, and I'm alive, and that's what's important," end quote.
Wow.
I mean, yeah, to him, that's what's important, that he's alive. That's probably one of the few times that he speaks the truth, because that's what's important to him. But I'd say for Manzanita's and Dolores' family, their murder might be pretty super important. That's what actually matters to them. So having the audacity to say something like that, you know how he talks? Now he's like people who were in a horrible accident and are the only ones who survived. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And even then you don't say, "And I'm alive and that's what's important." Like, ugh.
No. In fact, when that happens, I know from experience that, well, at least in my case, that's what other people were saying to me.
Exactly, yeah, because you yourself mostly have survivor's guilt if something like this happens.
Right.
Yeah.
You're not. It's how often he drops that mask and tells the truth. And wait till you hear some more of this stuff, because he has really been hiding in plain sight. He did it for such a long time. And he's the worst. He loves to play the victim, the dying swan, willing himself to die my ass. It's just, all right. So let's talk about this trial in October 1961. And this is where he's charged with grand larceny for that $10,000 from his wife Evelyn's mother or stepmother. So his attorney initially tries to have it thrown out on the grounds that there was no way he could get a fair trial since, while accused of theft, he was, quote, "in the minds of the jury and most of the Washington citizenry, accused of a galaxy of horror," end quote. Apparently, the defense even goes so far as to say, "You have to disregard all of this. The only thing found in the septic tank was pork and dentures. And this is all getting blown out of proportion." Like, it's appalling, the things that they're saying. They wait until they've gone through the motion of completely impaneling the jury, and they're asking jurors questions like, "Do you think he's a murderer?" Which, of course, everyone's like, "Objection, objection," but it's out, you know, it's out there, this kind of thing. And besides the fact, the reason that none of that's being talked about is because the charges that were holding him responsible for the deaths of Manzi and Dolores, which were actually just questioning him in regards to the mutilation of remains. It wasn't even that he was being held responsible. At the end of the day, the DA decided that he did not have enough evidence for a conviction. And it just blows my mind. After everything I laid out in the last episode about the body parts found and blood evidence found in his home, and they still didn't think that they could win a case without a body. It hadn't happened yet. It had only rarely happened in the United States, and there hadn't been one in Washington State. And I think Anne Rule also brings up the aspect of maybe it being an election year. But as far as I can tell, and I really sincerely hope I'm wrong about this, I'm sure I'll be getting little facts here and there wrong because it's just the nature of this kind of work. But as far as I can tell, I haven't seen any additional action taken to ever get justice for Manzanita and Dolores. I don't even know if the family was able to lay what remains they had to rest and have proper services. When Manzanita's ex-husband and Dolores's father passed away, neither of them are mentioned in his obituary. Now, that doesn't mean anything, but it would have been interesting to see if it said, you know, pre-deceased by, that sort of thing.
Mm.
I don't know. I can't imagine how traumatic this must have been for that family. Like, their mother and sister just didn't matter, right? I mean, they matter to us. Don't you think they had enough to convict even without a body?
I think so, yes. I mean, look, I'm not at all an expert on US law, and I know there's also big differences in the different states. Still, I'm kind of shocked they didn't go after him for murder, because I think there was so much evidence that the blood
so
spatter
much evidence
in the house.
Soaked in blood. That upstairs was absolutely soaked in blood. And people were saying how, like, he had moved out, like, right after Manzi left him. He had apparently moved down from upstairs and started sleeping downstairs. And he was claiming it was because it was too painful to be up there. Well, Yeah, because it was a blood-spattered, grisly nightmare, that kind of stuff. There was such an abundance of circumstantial evidence. I don't know. It baffles me. All right. So this trial is only about Guy stealing from the mother-in-law. His wife Evelyn is there. So is Guy's mother Sylvia and his brother Michael. All of them are there throughout the trial to support him. After a long and a very objectionable empaneling of jurors, so once it's all done, Guy's like, you know what? I don't want a jury trial. I'd rather have the judge decide. He's such an asshole. And this is a trial. So the defense attorney, Schroeder, he basically says that no, Guy was not trying to hide from the police, that he left a trail that was very easy to follow, and that they can excuse everything because his defense is basically that he lied because he lies about everything all the time and everybody knows it. So what did you expect? Like, that's the defense. The defense is he's just a huge liar. Everyone knows it. What did you expect? So this comes from that one great article that I mentioned before by Ruth Reynolds called Too Many Women, Too Many Lies. I found this article reprinted in at least a dozen different national newspapers, and I honestly don't know which one. I think she might have been a freelance, you know what I mean? Mm. All right, so I'm only going to read some excerpts from this, and I've edited it in minor ways just to make it more concise and clear, but this is the best coverage that I found on the defense at trial. Quote, Rockwell has amused and delighted people for 10 years with his storytelling, said Schroeder. No one believed him. There is a vast difference between the congenital liar and the wonderful storyteller. Sure, he fabricated, and he fabricated incredibly, but he was honest in his business. The high point of the trial was Rockwell's own testimony, telling why he was a liar, quote, in everything but business, and how he got into the mess he was in. It was an astounding defense. He said he got off to a bad start as a child because he resented being a Jew and a foster child. His foster brother Michael Moldovan went through Harvard Law School and then made a name for himself as an intelligence officer on General Douglas MacArthur's staff. And I... dot, dot, dot. Like, wow. I also think that he's intentionally playing up this adoption, calling his brother a foster brother, because I found a passenger manifest for the family for Albert, Sylvia, older brother Michael, and Guy. And it's from Cuba to New York City in early April 1925. So Guy is only a year old. So by age one, he is adopted and is traveling first class with his family. Maybe his parents were the kind I've met from time to time who treat the adopted child like an adopted child. I don't know. But it would be still incredibly weird to refer to Moose as my foster sister. Like, it's not even the right term. He's doing this to capitalize on Dickensian images of impoverished, orphaned children. You know what I mean? Just like I think him saying that he's, you know, the nose job was for, you know, exploiting systemic anti-Semitism. You know, it's like everyone's going to understand why I did this. I just hate him so fucking much, which I'm sure you can all tell and hopefully agree with me. Oh, and he also said that he started dyeing his hair the moment it started to turn gray. But the thing I find really weird is he wasn't found with dark hair. He had dark hair, and they even say he started dyeing his dark hair when it started to turn gray. He was found with red hair, which I wonder, did he, like, steal Manzanita's hair dye
also,
when he was...
didn't he constantly make himself older? Wouldn't he, like, embrace having gray streaks because it would validate his age?
Exactly. It's completely in opposition to him lying about his age.
Doesn't make sense, yeah.
Every single thing he says is a lie. It's wild. I've only met one person like this in my life, in college, and it's, I think you've also met one person like this, and it's like, yeah. So, okay, back to the article by Ruth Reynolds. Quote, he testified, talking about Guy, that he squeaked through high school and spent a few months at Alfred University. He was turned down for military service because of a bad leg and a ruptured eardrum. when he enrolled in the American Academy of Dramatic Arts in New York, according to his testimony, he decided to create a new identification for himself, patterned in many ways on his brother Michael's life. He changed his name and said he was a second lieutenant during World War II and had degrees from the University of California and the University of British Columbia. He claimed he had been a part owner of a Havana hotel. The more he lied, the more he had to lie. After two unsuccessful marriages, he fell in love with Evelyn Emerson and decided to lie no more. Quote, "I didn't want to go into this marriage like my previous two," he testified, "having someone marrying me knowing nothing about me." But somehow he kept right on lying. There was the time he felt self-conscious about his lack of military service because Evelyn's first husband had been in the French army. So, his best friend and the husband of Blake, Ron, wrote the Major Riley letter for him. Of course, he hadn't expected Ron to mail it. Of course. There was the business about the Fulbright scholarship his friend started, that false rumor, and he just didn't deny it. And then there was that silly foolishness about his owning a boat. End quote. So, we don't know if this is true about the letter, because his best friend Ron, Blake's husband, died of diabetes before the trial and couldn't testify. So he's blaming his dead best friend for the letter telling Evelyn's folks that he was a war hero. And honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if Guy did something to Ron. I think at that time it might have been very easy to kill somebody with serious diabetes. We'll never know. I just think it's very convenient. The person who maybe knew him the best and probably had some information that he probably didn't even know how damning it was, you know, wasn't there to testify to anything. All right, so now I'm going to finish this article, and now he's talking about the lies he told to scam his in-laws, right, out of the 10K. So he's on the stand for his own defense. And he says, quote, "Early in 1960, he heard about that collection from a man named Terry Devlin in Vancouver. He gave Devlin $500 to act as a picker or middleman in acquisition of the collection. Well, he told Evelyn about it, and then Mrs. Winkler literally forced the $10,000 check on him. Question by Attorney Schroeder. Why did you finally agree to accept the loan? Answer. I have never been able to refuse women."
Oh my God.
I knew you were going to love that, right?
Oh. I'm clenching my jaw.
I know.
So much right now.
I don't think you're alone. I don't think you're alone. He's the worst. So Rockwell testified that on August 3rd, he fully intended to go to British Columbia, but that very day, Devlin appeared in Seattle and demanded $1,500. That made Rockwell uneasy, for he'd only seen slides of the collection and he didn't even know the identity of the seller. He told Devlin he'd have to have more information before he could pay out money. Devlin said okay, he'd be right back with someone who had the information. But Devlin didn't come back. Quote, "And there I was with the $10,000, Rockwell continued sadly. I was expected to make money out of it. He decided to pick up some antiques in San Francisco, which he could sell for a quick profit. And when he thought of Blake, who had been begging him to take her to Portugal, he had wanted to tell her husband about her advances, but he just couldn't. Maybe if Ron discovered his wife in San Francisco, he'd find out what kind of girl she was." End quote. So now he's slut-shaming Blake. So he's having an affair with his best friend's wife to help him figure out what a slut she was. What a great friend! Okay, almost done with the trial. Quote, "The defendant was persuasive and might have been believed, this is the best, had not Daniel Terence Devlin, an antique dealer from Vancouver, taken the stand as an irate rebuttal witness. Devlin shouted that he had never discussed a collection of Indian artifacts with Rockwell. He had never received $500 grease money to act as a picker. He had never demanded $1,500 from Rockwell on August 3rd. He could prove that he was in Vancouver that day, not in Seattle. In summation, on Rockwell's 38th birthday, Schroeder pleaded, he deserves our compassion, not our vindictiveness and our malice. Judge James found Rocky guilty of grand larceny, a conviction which carries a maximum sentence
of 15 years imprisonment, end quote.
Let me take a wild guess here. He didn't get the maximum because he didn't have prior convictions. So I assume that it wasn't 15 years in prison for him.
More like 15 months at most. On Thursday, March 22nd, 1962, Judge Frank James suspended his sentence on the condition that he repay the $10,000 his mother-in-law had loaned him, and he was released from prison. I think he was in prison from December 1960 to March 1962, so 15 months. Mm. But he might have been out for part of that early time. I don't know that he was in. I think he might have been out on bail from time to time, but I'm not sure. I hope he was in jail the whole time. Now, to play devil's advocate and defend the judge, who I'm still very salty about, Guy's brother was there in court, like I said, as long as his mom and his wife. And he promised on behalf of the family that they were going to do everything they could to rehabilitate him. He and his mother offered to repay the money that was owed to Evelyn's mother. And the judge was told that Evelyn Rockwell was ready to welcome her beloved husband home to San Diego.
That's really wild to me.
I know. I know. Well, the thing is that's interesting, so I tried very hard to find some more information on Evelyn because I wanted to make sure she was okay. Like, after all of this, you know, I just, I was worried. Like, I just wanted to make sure she was okay. I wonder if some of this was just like saving face, like they just wanted this embarrassment. And I'm sure, I mean, it was a first for Evelyn, but I would be very, very surprised if this wasn't the first trouble that his family had bailed him out of, you know? I don't understand it either. Especially after she heard Blake's testimony. So she was in the courtroom listening to Blake explain that while Evelyn was worried that pirates had gotten her husband, he was off having a fling with his best friend's wife. That said, this is what the judge said about what he called a difficult aspect in the sentencing of Rockwell, because he, quote, is suspected of having committed a much more serious crime. It is my duty, the judge said, to completely eliminate the fact that I know what the suspicions of our police department and our community are, end quote. So, sorry, but the other suspected crimes are the body parts and blood evidence found in his home. We're not looking the other way on the other cons. Nobody gives a shit that he conned people, stole from them, slept with their wives. And I feel like the judge is kind of acting like those are the sort of crimes that he's disregarding, not a double murder and dismemberment, because this person was actually a danger to the community. I think most people, well, we know he did, because he did it again. I'm not mad that the judge didn't sentence him on murder charges. The judge had to deal with what he had to deal with. I'm just wishing that the judge looked at all the evidence, as well as Guy's openness about being a giant liar, and just sentenced him to the larceny crime that he was tried and found guilty for. Just give him the 15 years. Just.
I mean, yeah, I get why you're angry. I'm angry as well, but the judge really had to ignore, first of all, the body parts, as you said, and everything yeah. else, because that's what yeah. he wasn't on trial for. Anything else, and if he had no prior convictions and he was, in the eyes of the law, a first-time offender, it's right. really hard to give him the maximum of 15 years, I think. It would be here. I don't know how it's in the state, but...
I think it is here, too. I think truth in sentencing is a big problem, yeah. right? Because life isn't life, and I just wish he sentenced him for the larceny, because if he had just sentenced him to the 15 years, given him the maximum, because... Even if he just disregarded the suspected crimes and took into the demonstrated, repeated history of conning people and fleeing, right? If he had just served time for larceny, then he wouldn't have met Ruth Terry, married her, and then murdered her in 1974 because he'd still be in prison in Washington. I'm just so mad about it. I know I'm not alone. I know you are too. I'm just, you know? Mm. And that's it for a while. I suspect he initially went to San Diego to be rehabilitated by everybody and then bailed. He pops up again in the early 1970s. So in December of 1970, and again, sometimes research disillusions you on like random stuff you didn't even know you could be disillusioned about. So I found articles in December of 1970 about Guy Moldovan, executive vice president of David, I think it's pronounced David Orgel. It's a really high-end china and silver shop. And He's quoted in several articles about how well expensive things are selling this Christmas season. He's like, people are picking up these diamond-studded rocks and not putting them down. They're flying off the shelves. But then, like, the exact same quote is in an article about Christmas sales in 1971. And I'm like, oh, man, I thought they all had original articles each year. So that's where he was working, David Orgel's. It's funny, I looked up David Orgel's, and all I could find was, like, a paparazzi shot from 20 years ago of the one on Rodeo Drive, and it's Arnold Schwarzenegger shopping there. So that made me laugh. In 1973, that's where he's still working, per an ad for Help Wanted for the same shop. So listen, if you worked on the books, if you were above his position at David Orgel back in the early 1970s, and you had a problem with merchandise or money going missing or sales girls, I have some information for you, maybe.
Yeah.
At the end of Ann Rule's chapter on Guy, she writes, quote, "Public records show that a man named Guy R. Moldovan was married on February 16, 1974, to a woman named Terry in Washoe County, Nevada." End quote. She had no idea at the time that she had just very casually mentioned the name of Guy's next victim.
And the name of one of the most notorious cold cases in New England, and one of the most infamous Jane Does, I'd say.
I think so, yeah.
It's wild to think about it, right?
It brings up some goosebumps. Yeah, right? So let's talk about Ruth Marie Terry, who Guy married in Reno, Nevada, in 1974. She was born on September 8, 1936, in Whitwell, Tennessee. She was the youngest of three children born to Johnny Red Terry and his wife, Eva Lois Keener. She had two older siblings. She had a sister who was called Johnny Lois after both of her parents. She was the first born in March 1933. She was called Lois. And then they had a son, and they named him James. He was born in November of 1934. And then Ruth was only a year old when her beautiful mother, Eva, who had just turned 24, died suddenly. The cause of death on her death certificate is epilepsy. So there's no question they would have, just the family would have been devastated, and such a young family. But you can tell that this family, while not wealthy, has a lot of the more important qualities that will keep them going. They're very strong and loving and supportive. And you see that in the next census, because in the next census is 1940. And that's where you see Ruth, age 3, living with her sister Lois, age 7, and brother James, 5. And they are living with their dad and his parents. Also living with them is their uncle, their father's widowed brother, Frank, and his children. Both Frank and Johnny are listed as coal miners and widowers. By 1950, Johnny had remarried, and they had been blessed with three more children. 13-year-old Ruth is still home with them, and Johnny's profession has changed from miner to taxi driver. 17-year-old Lois, who I think had the same gorgeous, I think all of the children had the same just beautiful, bright blue eyes. She was newly married and living with her husband, who was also 17. I don't know why it mattered to me that, like, he wasn't 53 or something.
Yeah.
You know, they are just lovely, honestly. And they went on to have a really big, loving family, beautiful children, not without tragedy. One of their kids, I think it was their firstborn, was only 10 when every parent's worst nightmare happened, and he fell out of a tree that he was climbing and hit his head and did not survive the fall. So this family has had more than their share of loss, that is for sure. Ruth's brother James, who had the same smile and eyes that she has, it seemed he was working part-time in a sawmill at this point. He, I think, was still living with his grandparents, but very soon after this, he was going to be joining the army. And he also met a girl and fell in love and got married. The Terry family had been in Tennessee for a very long time, but if you go back far enough, you hit Ireland, and Johnny's red hair, that's why they called him Red, and blue eyes were passed on to some of the kids and grandkids, especially Ruth. When she was 20, she married a local boy, but she was young, they were both young, and it just didn't work out as they'd hoped. She left Tennessee and she moved to Michigan, where she had a job at an automotive factory in the Detroit metropolitan area. and it was there around 1958 that she found herself unmarried and pregnant. She had a really close friend named Pat, whose parents had hoped and hoped for another baby, but it just hadn't happened, and so an adoption was arranged. And Ruth would leave Michigan feeling that she had given her son a better chance for a good life that she was not equipped to provide for him at that time. He would be named Richard. She left Michigan for California, and this is presumably where she met Guy. We know from the FBI that she had some aliases, including Terry Marie Vizina, Terry M. Vizina, and Terry Shannon. And so one of the questions that I've heard a lot about this case that I think we can answer is it suspicious that she has so many names? And I would say, no, it's not. Because if you changed your last name when you got married, you have an alias or a legal AKA, otherwise known as. I have at least three of those, right? So I've got my maiden name, then I changed my name to Belle when I got married to my late husband, and then I changed my name again when I remarried Paul. I have two names that I don't even use regularly, not including my confirmation name. So, like, if you knew me in high school, I'm Ann Jackson. But, like, nobody has called me that for a million years. It's just been a natural evolution of what people call me. So, I don't think it's even a little bit suspicious. She also comes from a time period and a family where people commonly use nicknames as names. Right. Yeah. So, like, her dad was called Red, and her sisters went by the middle name Lois. Like, my grandmother went by Honey. No one ever called her by her name Anne. She was always called Honey. And my other grandmother was always called Mildred, even though that was her middle name. So, super, super, super common at that time. And people just changed their names to whatever they wanted a lot of the time back then, too. So, I wouldn't be surprised if people called her by her last name because it's a gender neutral. It's such a gender neutral name, Terry.
Yeah.
So if she just didn't love the name Ruth and people called her Terry, I just don't think it's weird. I don't think there's anything suspicious about it. I suspect Vizina could be an ex-husband I just couldn't find. But that's the name that she had when she married Guy in Reno, Nevada on February 16th, 1974. I might be putting too much thought into this entire case, and I'm probably doing this over and over and over again. And I hope I'm making it clear when it's my thoughts or my feelings or whatever, and I'm not putting words into anyone's mouth or anything, but I feel like he probably proposed on Valentine's Day and then they rushed off to elope. Because that way, he would avoid any possibility of like an announcement in a paper, which might stir up some old information. You know what I mean?
It's quite possible, yeah.
He's smart. This is the thing. He's not foolish. He's very clever. So Terry Marie Vizina and Guy R. Moldovan, he's gone back to his, I want to say maiden name, but that's not his given name. And he wasn't a stranger to her family, and neither was she. You know, the saying, like, all who wander are not lost, I think that was Ruth. She was in contact with her family. She stayed in touch with them. But you have to remember that this was another time. There was no texting or email, and long-distance calls were a huge, huge deal. So you would not expect very regular contact, but she definitely was not avoiding her family. When I was trying to find some information on how much calls were back in the 70s, and it was hard to find stuff, and I found a lot about how it depended on how far away you were going, you know, because the further you were, the more it cost. And I found a funny quote, which was good. It's just on flashback.com that said, quote, "Everyone remembers the Bell adverts from the 1970s. Reach out and touch someone," was the catchphrase. This was the phone company's attempt to show you that it didn't matter how insanely expensive long-distance rates were. Family and friends are more important. End quote. It's a great article about like an ad based around a guilt trip and how well it worked. So I'll link to it because it's interesting. But I don't want people to think that she didn't care because she wasn't in touch a lot. Like if you were a free spirit traveling around the country at this time, this was all normal. And Ruth's family has talked about the sort of person she was. She was vivacious and funny and fun. She loved to sing. Apparently she was just singing all the time and she wanted to see the world. She visited her family as often as she could, her nieces and nephews that she was close to. They remember her visiting and holding their babies. They said she was the sort of person who just oozed love. I love that description. You just knew it, you know, when she loved you. I hope I'm that kind of aunt. Like, I hope they all know how much I love them.
I'm sure. I think you are this kind of person.
I hope. Her half-brother, Ken, so that was from her dad's second marriage. He was 6 when she was 13 in the 1950 census, and he remembers being close to her, and he remembered that she brought her new husband, Guy, to meet the family, and that they were traveling around the country shopping for antiques, which, let's face it, is a pretty great lure, yeah. Right? Like, let's elope. We'll travel around the country and buy antiques. I think that's, like, the list of the way the serial killer gets me. That's second, right after there's a puppy in the car, is, like, let's drive around and look for antiques. Okay, let me get into your giant van. This is fine. She also has a great niece named Brittany, and she spoke to one of our local news channels, and so I was able to watch the footage. I have links to all this that I'm going to be posting this incredibly huge source list for you all, but you can watch it. She's beautiful, and she's got that gorgeous red hair. And in the interview, she recalled that the family said that Ruth seemed like a different person when she was with Guy, that he seemed to control her. So that's also not surprising, is it? I read the family met him just before they were married, and I've also read just after. It could have very well have been both. But either way, one day, her devastated husband, I assume sometime in July of 1974, shows up and tells the Terry family that Ruth has left him. She sold all of her clothes and has joined a cult. He travels to Tennessee to tell them this, and then he's like, okay, bye, and they don't see him again. He just nopes out of there. So the family doesn't believe this for even a minute. They had no idea about, obviously, they had no idea about anything that had transpired 2,500 miles away in Seattle 14 years ago. I'm definitely putting words into their mouths here. I think they just saw through the bullshit and immediately suspected foul play. I firmly, firmly believe, again, my opinion, that Guy was a textbook case, textbook of antisocial personality disorder. And he had that ability that we see so often to charm and bamboozle otherwise very intelligent and capable people. And I think he was just really good at pretending to be whatever the thing he wanted you to see was, right? A war hero, a Fulbright scholar, born in Saint-Tropez and educated in Switzerland. Oh, a victim of the foster care system. You know, he just does it over and over, however it suits him, and it works every fucking time. Every time. I understand why Herb Swindler was so about this guy. But there are those who see through it, right? Manzanita's sister absolutely did, because remember, they stopped talking because she hated him so much. Her husband, William, who was Dolores's father, of course, saw through it. And I think the Terrys saw through it. So Ruth's either, when they got this news, it was either her brother or her father. I think it's her brother, James. It doesn't really matter. But her family, one of them immediately traveled to California to try to find her. And when they couldn't find any information, he hired a private investigator who was also really unable to come up with anything because, of course, she had been murdered on the opposite coast in the very, about as far east as you can get. And they never saw her again. And her nephew said it just always seemed so weird that he'd come, said she was missing, and then just left without waiting to see if she could ever be found.
It's so suspicious.
It is, but it's also such a good lie. Because also, and this is not a judgment in any way about Ruth, she was kind of a free spirit, right? So if she was the kind of person who stayed at home and never spread her roots anywhere else, then you could see, like, this would be very strange or, you know, but she had gone off on flights of fancy before that had sometimes worked out and sometimes not. And I think at that time, it was just such a good lie because the super shitty aspect of this particular lie is this is a time period that was heaving with cults, right?
So many.
So many cults. So even though deep down, I know they knew that something had happened, they suspected foul play. They didn't believe that she would ever be gone so long without reaching out, you know? But I think what Guy's lie did is it creates a situation where they always had hope that maybe she had joined a cult, which is 100% understandable because you don't want to think she's dead. You want to think she's out there hitting a tambourine somewhere, you know, free love, you know, whatever. When Jonestown happened in 1978, I guess her dad and her brother, like, they were just glued to the TV, desperately looking for a glimpse of red hair. It's devastating. And of course, Ruth had already been lost to them for 4 years at that point. And just really quickly, like, I just looked up some of the cults that were active within, like, a decade of this time period, right? And we have, these are just a few. Marshall Applewhite and the crew, who would become Heaven's Gate. The Children of God, the People's Temple, of course, because I just mentioned Jonestown. The Church of the Lamb of God, the Rajneesh, how do you pronounce it? It's Rajneesh, the Rajneesh group. And, of course, the Manson family. And I know so many of our listeners are yelling more and more and more cults at us because this was a big thing at that time and in that place. And if you're hearing news about cults every day on the radio, it all just seems a little bit more plausible, right?
As you say, it's possible. Yeah.
Anything's better than thinking that they're dead.
Yeah.
That's how I would feel, personally. That's how I would feel. I would just always kind of hold out that maybe hope. I don't know. But again, I think it's fascinating that we see this pattern here. Guy went and told Ruth's family that she left him and joined a cult. And this is such a pattern with him, right? Before someone can notice their loved one might be missing, he notifies them that he's upset. He calls Manzanita's ex-husband. Have you seen her? I'm so worried. She's left me. She's stolen from me. I don't know where she's gone. He gets ahead of it and plays the victim, you know? And when you immediately make yourself the victim, it's a lot harder for people to be angry with you or force you into hard conversations, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He's smart. So in reality, this is probably what happened. Sometime in early July 1974, they found themselves in Provincetown. It's the most popular season to visit, one of the most beautiful places in this big, beautiful country that I'm lucky to live in. A place where Guy's father, Albert, had lived and bought and sold many, many properties. I think Albert may still have had a home there. I could be wrong, but I think he may have still had property at that time. It might have been sold. But he probably still had connections, and we have no reason not to think that Guy spent time there visiting his father. And so there she is in Provincetown, just on a beautiful summer day, and you can hear the wind in the trees and the waves and the seagulls and like that muted sound, you know, of like the laughter of children, but it's far away and kind of on the breeze, so it's not annoying. It's just beach sounds. And she was lying on one side of a green blanket that she'd been sharing. She's sunbathing nude with her husband by her side, using her neatly folded jeans as a pillow, and she falls asleep. And that is when Guy, her husband, killed her instantly with a blow to the head, which crushed her skull. There's no sign of a struggle. When she was found weeks later on July 26, 1974, by a young girl in her beagle, she had been posed to appear as though she were sleeping in the nude, and her arms had been arranged to appear as though her hands were sort of dug into the sand, but actually her hands had been removed, as had several teeth, and a clear attempt was made to remove her head. But it seems he may have feared interruption and left the scene before completing that task, which is how we know she had red hair. Also, if you remember, near the body, they found a large SOS drawn in the sand. Mm. And when we first covered it, we were like, well, it could be kids, or it could have been a really sick fucking joke. And now I think it actually was a really sadistic joke. Yeah, I do. I do. I think he would have found it funny. I do. Unfortunately. Yeah. We go a lot more into the evidence at the scene in episode 20, but the overwhelming takeaway from me in this is that he had learned from murdering his second wife and stepdaughter that if the body couldn't be identified, he would probably get away with it. and he had to make sure that she wasn't identified because he married Ruth using his real name, and her family had met him. They knew what he looked like. They knew his name. He used his real name. And if anyone had figured out who she was, how long, right, before they immediately, I mean, literally the moment they realized who she was, and they knew. And as he told Herb Swindler, he would never put himself into a position to be hanged. And it worked.
I mean, he got away with it.
He got away with it. It's also interesting to me that as far as I know, and I would love it if anyone out there could fill us in, if any family are listening. It's interesting to me that as far as I know, the three women he murdered all had red hair. I wasn't able to confirm what color hair Joellen, Evelyn, Blake, or his future partners had, but the women he murdered are 3 for 3 redheads. And red is the rarest hair color, with less than 2% of the world's population having red hair. Manzanita was, I guess she was more of a technicality. Manzanita was more like me, like born with red hair that got dark, dark, dark as she got older, but she did dye it back to that red she had when she was a child. So she was still, I would say, counts as a redhead, maybe. Did he only date redheads, only marry redheads, only murder redheads? He was a collector of rare and precious things. I wouldn't be surprised if he kept hair from each of them. And he ran an antique store, so it wouldn't surprise me if he hid them in plain sight, like in Victorian mourning jewelry or something like that. I think that was highly likely. All right. Can you tell how many classes I took that were like criminal profiling? I'm fascinated by it. All of it. All of it. I hope it isn't boring for all of you. All right, let's get back to the case. So there were multiple attempts to identify the murdered Jane Doe, known lovingly to those familiar with her story as the Lady of the Dunes or Our Lady of the Dunes. She'd been exhumed many times at an attempt to find a match with DNA or to do drawings of what she may have looked like. They were revised and revised and revised over time as technology and art and science of all of this improved. I'm not going to get into all of it again. We have it all detailed in previous episodes, but I will say another question that's been answered is, how did nobody see these pictures and come forward? So I posted the many, many photos and sketches done over the years in our Facebook group yesterday, just to see what other people thought and to see if there was anything I was maybe missing. And apart from the eye shape in one, which is actually really close to her eye shape, but the rest of it is completely off. It's like she's got very dark hair and tan skin, so it just throws the whole thing off, and you'll see it, but none of them are accurate. They're a great investigative tool. I don't want to in any way diminish how important and how useful they can be, but sometimes not. And in this case, she doesn't look like any of them, do you think?
No, she doesn't.
No.
I mean, the hair, no. Maybe, possibly. I don't know.
Yeah.
But
the red hair.
Yeah.
But that's
it. Yeah. And they all look so different from each other even, so.
Totally different. Totally different. Another reason that contact sort of got a little bit lost is, so she had one of her best friends and her birth son's older sister, Pat. She was always in touch with her. They wrote constantly, but Pat stopped hearing from her, of course, when Ruth was murdered, not knowing why. And then in 1980, Pat was murdered by her husband, and the line of communication was gone for good. And poor Richard, losing his sister in that way, and then finding out the way he lost his mother. So, all right, back to our timeline, where on October 18th, 1975, Guy Moldovan, 55, marries 39-year-old Phyllis Roper. Phyllis had just gotten divorced in November of 1974. So that seemed, again, like less than a, is it just me, or is that quick? I guess maybe if you had to wait for a long time, but he murders Ruth in July 1974, and in October 1975, he's married again. I mean, it's typical for him, but
don't you think it's possible? Like, it appears to me that he murders out of convenience.
Yes.
Because he wants to gain something.
Yeah.
That he had met a new woman, tried to get rid of Ruth. Maybe she didn't want a divorce. Maybe, you know, I don't know. I feel like the reason for murdering for him was always his own convenience and his own advantage.
Exactly. I don't think he was a Ted Bundy type. Yeah, exactly. Like where he felt compelled to kill. He killed for the killing. I don't think. I agree. I think it was just when it was easy for him for what he wanted to accomplish, you know? Also, in 1975, I found in the newspaper, it looks like he is suing his brother Michael and, quote, all unknown owners or proprietors of the premises and unknown heirs interested in the premises, end quote. This, I think, best I can figure, is he wants to divide land in New Mexico. I'm guessing this belonged to his mother, who passed away in July of 1975. So I think he's trying, I think as soon as his mother died, he immediately tried to force his siblings into buying him out or risk losing the land, which probably meant something to the rest of them because they have feelings. Okay, the next thing I found is weird and maybe very problematic. In 1976, Guy wrote a book called Rump Oil, and it's a cookbook.
What?
Yeah, it's very, very hard to find any. It's been out of print for a very long time. I was able to find on Reddit, there was some discussion about it right after he was found, and somebody said they had it and they would post some pictures. And then other people on Reddit started getting complainy and snarky and rude. And so the person who had the book only just posted one picture because they were like, well, you guys can jump off a dock because whatever. So we have the cover page, and we'll post pictures because I think it's fine. This says, to my wife Phyllis Smearl, so that was her maiden name. Her constant urging kept me from wasting time trying to become King of the United States, Red China, and Greenland all at the same time, or to pursue my nearly perfect efforts at flying without the use of craft or wings. Phyllis has proved to me that love, beastology, and rump oil can walk together, hand and paw. Copyright 1976 by Guy Moldovan, ISBN 0914202421. So there's this.
I love how he thinks he's being like funny or tongue-in-cheek, but it's actually... we know he means it. I mean, he would love to be all these things. He'd love to be king. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. This is one of the poems that people are making a big deal about. And the name of it is Cape Cod Shid. S-H is shit, but with a D. It's apparently slang and has been slang for a long time. I think it comes from his stint as a beat poet. When he was found in Greenwich Village, he was like a beat poet. Cape Cod Shid. It's... There's a drawing that he's done. What would you say it's a drawing of?
It looks like a sloth.
Oh, it kind of does. Okay.
Like, that's what I... When I looked at it, I thought it's a sloth.
Yes, I could see that. I thought it looked like a severed breast with eyes.
Huh. It's a sloth to me.
So the poem says... Out of the water and into the pan, the only way to cook the shit. After the shit is caught, anything over 5 minutes ends it. The sweet turpentine taste will turn to that of a burnt glove, and the tender look will become one of despair. Remember, just 5 minutes, don't cook the shit out of it.
The fuck?
So, I haven't been able to find, like I said, any of this stuff, but... What it brings back to me and others is the fact that Dolores's ribs were partially burned. No other evidence was mentioned as being found burned, despite the fact that there's a photo of Gail Leonard, one of the detectives, sifting through the fireplace ashes at the Seattle Gallery. And a lot of blood evidence was mentioned all over that house and in the septic tank and all over the place, but nothing in the fireplace. So there's just some concern that... That there's a cannibalistic aspect.
You know what? I wasn't there for episode 2, but I listened to it I have the feeling the burned rib is him trying several ways of disposing of the body.
You think so?
Yeah, that's what I think. That's what the first thing that came to my mind was. Because it was so all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
The way he got rid of them.
It was. That was the only thing. I just thought it was interesting that the only part they found charred were ribs.
Yeah, because they didn't find a whole lot of things, right? So.
Right. That's true. That's true.
I can see him trying to burn the bodies, and that doesn't work.
Maybe there was a fire somewhere else. I just can't figure out where he would have burned them.
Yeah.
Because I think they would have found evidence if it was in the fireplace, unless they've withheld that, and that's possible. Maybe there's more information that Anne ruled.
Maybe in the yard. Maybe. I don't know.
I think it's really thickly settled, and the neighbors that mentioned, like, the smell of the septic system and stuff, I think that they would have noticed if there was a, but you never know. I hope you're right. I really hope you're right.
I can be completely wrong. I just don't see him as this kind of murderer. I see him as someone who would try to get rid of them as soon as possible.
Yeah. I don't think he's the sort who would... I don't think that's the reason. Like, we've talked about lots of people who killed people for the purpose of eating them. Like, that was the focus. I just wouldn't be surprised if he was the sort of killer who was like, well, let's see what it's all about.
Hmm.
Let's see what, let's just see what the fuss is about. It's a weird book title. It's a weird cookbook. It's a weird, I want to see more of it. I think it's all going to be weird.
It's super weird.
Yeah.
It's very weird. Still can't figure out. I mean, a severed breast with eyes could also be possible.
It's probably because I just had a mammogram. It's like looking down.
It could also be a... if that's
a hair.
Hair.
A woman looking up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was what I saw the first time. Was a woman looking... Like, someone looking up with a nose up and then hair. Yeah, that was the first thing I saw. Like, hair that looked like spaghetti. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm.
You could see a lot of potential stuff.
Yeah.
So then, moving along, in February 1983, there's a report in the Californian that he has been appointed to a county water district board of directors. Then there's a puff piece. All right, so this is another thing that you're going to see a lot. There's a little puff piece in the Californian published on July 1st, 1985, and it's by Hope Belli, B-E-L-L-I. And it's called, "This Guy Can Gab," get it? "Talk show host keeps listeners up late." The article is about Guy's radio program where he hosts as a volunteer this 3-hour call-in show on aging, growing, and making transitions. And I want to read a little bit of this out loud just because the authorities are still trying to find out more information on Guy and where he was and what he was up to at various points in his life. And it's possible someone may remember him from the 1980s. And also, oh my God, the audacity. All right, so this piece says, quote, "Muldovan, who says he is, quote, over 60, experienced major transition in his life about 9 years ago. He decided to retire from his job as an executive vice president of David Orgel's, a China crystal and silver store on Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills. Since then, some of his many projects include writing a cookbook entitled Rump Oil, working as devil's advocate for Jerry Brown's presidential campaign, trying his hand in the recording industry and losing his shirt, working with youth through the Santa Monica Police Department, and various writing projects." It then goes on and says, "During the show, Muldovan draws on his experiences and conversations with other people to deal with topics such as cuts in Social Security, Alzheimer's disease, and feelings about old people having sex. Branching out from topics which focus on old people, Muldovan has introduced programs dealing with homosexuality, the erosion of culture, and his belief that killing has become a habit."
Whew.
End quote. Yep. Then there's just a bunch of nonsense about his thoughts. And then it says, quote, "Hosting a public radio program on aging has long been a dream of Muldovan's, but the age discrimination he detected while trying to find a job in this area caused him to make the program. When he moved to the area, he said, despite his 30 years experience as a buyer with major stores, the only job an employment agency could find for him was as a Santa Claus at Macy's. He found his own clerk jobs, but he says the fact that someone of his age and experience is working at an entry-level job makes him morally suspect. Quote, "If you're my age and you're going to take a lousy job," Moldovan said, "you've either been in prison, or there's something mentally wrong with you, or you're a drunk," end quote. Moldovan says he wants to stay in the mainstream of society as he grows older, end quote. Then it goes on and he complains. He's like, "What we want to do is work because we have no savings, so we have to work. So just let us work." It's like, oh, the audacity. People make a really big fuss about the "killing has become a habit" comment because obviously it has for him. But the whole piece is so incredibly incriminating. And again, with playing the victim. Not all sociopaths are narcissists. This one is, I think. And that's it. We don't see much until he dies and goes straight to hell after a long illness. I know, right? I'm sorry. Not sorry. March 14th, 2002. And so we found his obituary. I was kind of surprised by, to be honest. I was expecting a very long, self-aggrandizing, like, thought he would have written his own, you know what I mean, obituary. And it's just "The Californian, 15 March 2002. Guy Moldovan, 78, of Salinas, died Thursday, March 14th, at his home following a lengthy illness. He was born on October 26, 1923, in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and lived in Salinas for 22 years. He was a buyer with Bullocks and an artist, actor, and poet. Okay? Survivors. Wife Phyllis Moldovan and sister Joan Towers. And then it just goes on and says private services and cremation. So, yeah.
I mean, I know he had several siblings, but I thought they didn't have any contact with him. So why is one of his sisters, his sister Joan?
Ah, she's the Ann Cleves of this story.
Okay.
So she and Guy apparently dated for a while. And then they decided that they were more like brother and sister. Mm-hmm. And then they lived like brother and sister after that, which would be really sweet if he wasn't the actual worst. He's the worst. But Ruth's family never stopped looking. Her niece, who I think also goes by her middle name, who went by her middle name, I think she's passed, Renee, she had also had that gorgeous red hair. She had visited Ruth and Guy in California. And so as time passed, she decided to send her DNA in the hopes that she might be able to reconnect and find Ruth's son, her nephew Richard, who had been given up for adoption. And then just like me, Richard had decided to do an ancestry panel to see what his ancestry was and to find some relatives. Ruth had reached out to him about a year before she was murdered. But he was only 13 and he was very, very sick in the hospital at the time and he just wasn't ready. And honestly, I think no kid that age is ready, you know. But he finds, and he feels a lot of guilt about it, I heard in one interview, and that just makes me want to give him a hug and just say, don't feel guilty about that. The only thing she cares about is that you were taking care of yourself and it's all good. Don't waste time on that one, you know. So he finds relatives of his mother in 2018 in Tennessee, and so everyone's really overjoyed to have reconnected. And they tell him that his mom had been missing since the early 70s. And because they were in DNA databases, when a new company that is able to work with DNA that hadn't been usable before, either because it was a tiny sample from a crime scene or was degraded by, I think, embalming fluid, formaldehyde, something like that was part of it, this company called Othram, it's run by Kristen and David Middleman, and they're the founders of this private DNA lab in Texas. And they can get results with far, far less material than other labs can at the moment. So it's really ideal for crime scenes with trace DNA. And it's solving more and more DOE cases and crimes. I saw Kristen on a news program here called Chronicle, and she was talking about how the levels that they now need are so minute that as this tech is continuously perfected, you know, we could potentially get to a point where DNA will really become such a deterrent to crime because it will be so easily detected at crime scenes, you know, like just breathing in a room, they'll be able to tell you were there, that kind of thing, like in the future. It's fascinating. It's also not legal everywhere, and it can be a really hot sort of topic for privacy issues for some people. So then Richard gets a call from the FBI, and unfortunately, it's not good. They didn't find Ruth in a cult. Richard found out that his birth mother had passed. And it was the same for me, actually. When I found my birth father, he had already passed. October 31st, 2022, which I thought was interesting because Ruth's brother James died on Halloween 2005. The Boston branch of the FBI, they have a press conference along with the Massachusetts State Police assigned to the case, assigned to the Cape and Islands office, DA Michael O'Keefe, the Provincetown Police Department, and the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Massachusetts. They have a big press conference, and they announce that the Lady of the Dunes is Ruth Marie Terry. Sister, daughter, mother, aunt, we found her. We found her name, we found her family, and we knew that they were looking for her the whole time, and we were right. James Meads, who was the chief of police in Provincetown, he never stopped trying to identify Ruth. His son, Jimmy Meads Jr., has been to his dad's grave to tell him who Ruth was, but I think they've been well acquainted since 2006 when he passed. And I, again, hope I'm not putting words into people's mouths, but my sense from all the interviews I've seen with law enforcement involved with this case, especially more recently, they really felt like whoever killed her was probably dead and real justice was not terribly likely. Mm. They still, just like we did, wanted to know who she was, who had been on their minds, you know, for such a long time, for such a long time. If any of Ruth's family are listening and you've never been to Cape Cod, I would be so happy to show you around, take you on a whale watch. Anything I can do to help, I would be so happy. Please reach out and just let me know. I'm so sorry that she was another bright, beautiful woman who was killed by this awful man, and I'll always wonder what happened and why she needed to die. Manzanita, I think, crossed a line when she confronted Guy. I think he didn't like his women to fight for him, sort of, and I think he probably snapped when she confronted her, and then he had to kill Dolores, who was probably a witness. I don't know what happened with Ruth because there was no struggle. Police don't think that she was moved either. So I think that he just maybe let the mask slip. Maybe she heard or saw something she shouldn't have. I don't know. I think to her family, I would just like to say, I know it's not easy, an easy thing to do. I struggle with this myself. But if you can compartmentalize a little bit and sort of push the things aside, because there were terrible, terrible things done to her, but they were done after she passed away. And just remember the fact that she was in a truly beautiful place. She went to sleep on a blanket next to someone she loved, and the next thing she knew, she was back with her mother. Or she closed her eyes and she went to sleep and she never woke up, if you don't believe in any kind of afterlife. Either way, I can't think of a better way to go. Please, may everyone I love lay down next to someone they love, close their eyes, drift off to sleep, and pass. What an absolute gift, really. All the awful things that were done to her were done after she was killed by a sudden swift blow to the head. She didn't suffer, and we know that. And we didn't know her name, but she was known to us. She wasn't just someone that no one could identify and that everyone forgot. She mattered to the police and to locals like me and to members of the true crime community. And I am just so glad that the Lady of the Dunes finally has her name back. And now we can remember Ruth Marie Terry.
Okay.